be Irulau. Watch your back, watch your back. A chance is gonna get you. Watch your back, watch your back. A chance is gonna get you. Watch your back, watch your back.
Oh, there's a giant here. It's a coming from the Escaleria. Gotta wash those red hands. It's the crimes of the Basslands. It's the crimes of the Basslands.
Hi, Douglas.
Hi, Julie. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
Not bad. Not bad. It's a nice weather. A little bit chilly,
finally.
But
spring has sprung.
Springing.
Yeah, at the time of recording, it's still April. Yeah. Have you had a good week?
Yeah, it was chill. Nothing too much. It's kind of a bit, it's like we're coming back from Easter.
Yeah, that
was
really rough.
One or two of my classes haven't started up. So
hard time. Nobody wants to be in school, and I don't want to be there either. So
yeah, you can smell summer already.
I know. Everybody's like, come on, let's get this over with. And I'm the same way, so it doesn't help.
True.
As the teacher. True. Like, come on, guys, it's great to be here. No. Yeah. But anyway.
Yeah. So it was chill. It was less, not all my classes, one or two are like on holiday.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Yeah, so this is Crimes of the Basslands.
Yeah, welcome to a true crime podcast.
Yeah, there's lots of crime.
There's lots of crime. Sometimes it's minor.
Sometimes it's major. What are we drinking tonight?
We're drinking some delicious beer.
Yes, we're having...
From the Basque Country.
Yeah, we're having Basque Land Brewery.
It's so good.
Imparable.
A favorite of the podcast. I think we can
totally
definitely
love Imparable.
We don't get it for a podcast too much, but we love it inside and out.
Inside and out, and whenever we're out. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else we need to cover before we get started today?
I mean, this is a part two. I mean, it's not too gory, right? It's kind of mom safe.
It is. Mm. It's gory. I mean, but it's not like a serial killer that's doing really horrible things to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty horrible crime.
It is, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So if you listen to part one and you're listening to part two, then you already know that, you know.
And if by some chance you're here, maybe start with part one?
No, absolutely start with part one. Because we're going to resume the story about Elena Giovanni, who in 2001... December of 2001, she was found murdered in Sabadell, which is like a town outside of Barcelona.
Yeah.
And so this is in Catalonia, yeah.
And her name is Catalan as well, for people who pay attention to these things.
And
it
I'm probably not
different.
Pronouncing things correctly, so just
but we looked it
forgive
up.
Me.
It was with a J.
Giovanni,
But our Basque link was a little bit tenuous, but it was one of the suspects.
One of the suspects has a Basque surname and was born in Baracaldo.
Yeah.
So she was born in Bilbao.
So most of our story is just lightly connected, but it's...
But it's a tenuous link,
clear
and
connection.
That's all we need.
Clear connection. He was from Baracaldo, so...
Yep.
No getting out of it.
And then the only disclaimer I have for this, this episode is that there's a suicide... in the story, so there's a mention of suicide, so there you go.
Yes.
There's your disclaimer.
We've been warned.
And of course, murder.
Yes, so, of course.
Because it was a murder
in this case,
that we're talking about.
It is.
So I'll kind of give you like a little summary about what happened. She was found in an interior patio of some buildings of flats. She was... Some reports say she was nude, others say partially nude.
Right.
And that she had burns on her body and that she had died from the impact of a fall from the fourth story of a building.
Right.
So when she fell, they determined that she had been semi-conscious or unconscious. And that they found like 35 times the amount of benzodiazepine.
Yeah.
That's the name of the drug that was found in her body. At first, they couldn't identify who she was. They didn't know
what apartment that she was from.
Yeah, like what was she like a neighbor? They discovered she wasn't a neighbor. And her family you know, report when they reported her missing, they linked this found woman to someone they were looking for, right? So they found, so they linked her to this, the family found her that way.
Right.
Like when they reported her missing because she hadn't been around for like 3 days or something.
Yeah.
So, that's and then the months preceding her death, she had a couple of like mystery notes appear.
True. Yeah.
At her house. So, like in September, she received a note. And then as we get to that, I'll go ahead and read you those notes when we get to that part of the story.
Yeah.
So in September, she received a note with some like pastries and a drink.
Yeah.
And then the second time was like in October, she received another note, mystery note and some drink, and she drank the drink in the second one.
Right.
Which then immediately made her
not feel
kind of, yeah, not feel well, but also like kind of go into like a unconscious state.
Yeah,
like she had to be taken home,
her,
and
her workmates had to take her home, right?
It was
pretty crazy.
And so she, because she was like a journalist student, she took the drink to be analyzed and found that it had this same drug that they found in her body when she died.
Right.
So she kind of did her own investigating.
Yeah.
And then later she was found dead with this same drug in her body.
Yeah, 10 points, Ms. Jubani.
So that's kind of the summary, okay?
Yes.
So when we left off, the police were focused on... So she was part of this hiking club, right? That was the only link they could kind of... Like, they were trying to look into her life and who she knew and stuff. So she was linked to this hiking club. And so there was a couple, Monse and Santi were one of the couples. And then there was this guy, Chabi... Haume, and then this girl, Anna Echequivial. Echequivial.
Echequivial.
And that's the Basque link.
All right.
So these people were all part of the hiking club, right? They were looking into these people, and the building where she had been thrown off of... was occupied. There was somebody that lived in a building adjacent that was from this hiking club.
Yeah.
And that was Monse and her boyfriend, Santi.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the judge in the case essentially thought this was like a woman's thing. He looked at the notes he thought this is like something among women.
All right.
For some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So... the police were like decidedly focused on the women in the hiking group.
Mm.
And Montserrat is her full name, Monse Carreta, and Anna Echequivial. They compared those women's handwriting from their like registration forms for the hiking club to the anonymous notes that she had received.
Yeah, I remember that bit.
So they did a handwriting analysis, and then they linked those two women, saying that they matched. So the mysterious notes that she received matched the handwriting of these two women. So they started focusing on those two women as perpetrators.
I remember those things. Thanks for reminding us.
Yeah. So there you go. That's a good
We're caught up.
Summary, right?
We're All caught right. up. Yeah.
Police focused on Monse. Because she lived in the building that was adjacent to where the body was found.
Yeah, I remember she didn't want to speak to them at the first time the police
came over. Came around and she was just like, no, I don't know anything about it, and closed the door in their face, basically.
Yeah, it was a bit weird,
yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, the first time they went around, they couldn't get an answer, so they thought maybe she was the victim.
It's true, I remember that.
Because, they couldn't get an answer to that door, and they knew it was a young woman about the same age as the victim.
Yeah.
And then they went back, and then she didn't really... got really uncomfortable talking to them. So they, determined her handwriting matched both of the anonymous notes. So her handwriting was linked to both notes. Whereas Anna's only linked it to the second one because there was two different handwriting samples on the second note.
Okay.
They knew that she hadn't acted alone, but they needed more time and evidence to connect the other two suspects, which was Monse's boyfriend, Santiago La Iglesia, and Anna, the other female that was being looked into. So on February 12th, 2002, Montserrat
Carreta was arrested at 2 p.m. And she was sent to Huadra's prison to be held without bail while the investigation continued to look into the other two suspects.
That's intense.
The same day as her arrest, the police finally decided to conduct a search of her apartment. Okay. So they waited 2 months before looking at her apartment for any evidence.
Yeah, talk about
loss. So that is one thing that was mentioned a lot in this Crims. Remember I told you one of the sources was this Crims documentary, which is apparently it started out as a radio show, and then they created a docu-series type show on Netflix.
I didn't know that.
With the same name, about Catalan crimes.
Yep. Our competitors, but they're way ahead. We're not really competitors.
Our competitors in what? True crime?
Yeah. Like
somebody needs to have a crimes regional, of the Catalan.
Yeah.
Lands. Catalan lands.
Yeah, crimes of the Catalan lands. That's
somebody, come on.
I mean, that's basically them, right? Crimes.
Well, yeah, they've already done it. They're on Netflix.
Yeah,
they've beat us big time. So they finally decided to search her apartment, and what they found was damning for Monse.
She had two months to clean up, and she didn't do anything. Yeah.
So in her bedside table, they discovered two boxes or bottles. I put boxes / bottles because some sources said bottles, but we all know that when you buy drugs from the pharmacy, they're in boxes.
Yeah, they have.
So I'm assuming it was a box. Not a bottle.
Yeah. Maybe.
So anyway.
But even a bottle would come in a box. So, you know, that's what I was thinking initially.
Excuse me. Yeah. So I'm going to say boxes because that's probably how they had the drugs.
In any case.
So in her bedside table, they discovered two boxes of Noctamid. Mm-hmm. Noctamid. It's a psychoactive drug with hypnotic effects that contains diazepine, that's right, diazepine, which was the same substance that they had found in her body at her death.
It is. I remember that.
So one of the boxes was full and the other one was completely empty.
Oh.
But they had an empty box in the bedside table.
So damning.
Yeah.
So easy to get rid of.
So they also located a box of matches. Okay, so if you'll recall on the terrace where she was thrown from at the top of the building, they had found her clothing, Elena's clothing, and there was matches that had been burnt because they poured like perfume or cologne over her to set her on fire a little bit.
Yeah, very weird.
Because she had burns on her body and stuff. They burnt like her bra and underwear and stuff with this. So they found a box of matches that matched the matches that they found on the terrace.
I know, that's crazy. I mean, you guys have matches, but I don't have matches in my house.
I have matches in my house.
I mean, I have a lighter, but I don't have matches.
But matches are good for the bathroom.
I know, oh,
but right, you don't live with anyone.
Yeah, I don't.
So you don't need to like hide your smell from anyone.
No, just close the door.
Yeah, we have matches in all the bathrooms. And I always forget to bring them on trips with me, so I don't embarrass myself at people's houses.
That's so cute. Yeah.
Santi was present at the search of the apartment.
What?
Yeah, because it seemed as though he was living there. Like, living there, not living there.
Okay.
Like, that was kind of his defense, that he didn't live there.
Right. I remember they were like, oh, we went to eat at my parents, and then...
Yeah, so he said he had slept at his parents' house the night that she disappeared, And there was a big debate about whether or not he lived at that apartment with Monse.
Right.
So he was there when they came to search the apartment, though.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been there for a full 6 hours before they came to search it. Because she got arrested at like 2 p.m. And then they came at like 8 p.m. to search.
Wow.
So he knew she's getting arrested.
Yeah. He didn't throw out the boxes.
Exactly.
It's crazy, right? People are so...
And he was a criminal lawyer. Remember? He was like a lawyer.
It's true. I totally forgot about that.
Specializing in criminology, this Santi. Okay?
He must be a psychopath, you know? Like, these people kind of really think they know everything.
Or let's... Well, we'll get into it.
Okay. You have other theories?
Well, a lot of people have a lot of theories. And I'm just going to relay them to you. Because I guess I have my own, but I'm kind of like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, I agree with these theories that people put out. So it was proven that he had been there the whole time since her arrest because he had made phone calls from the apartment during this time. Yeah, from the landline.
That is crazy. This time. Like, who uses a landline 2024? I mean,
no, it's 2021. It's 2001.
Oh, that's a long time. Okay, yeah. so that, my match is...
Or 2002, because this is in February. The death occurred in... it was like December 2nd of 2001.
So he made some phone calls from the flat during this time, and one of which was placed to Monse's sister, Inma.
Inmaculada.
So, Inma, yeah. Is that what it comes from?
Usually.
Immaculada. That's true. Immaculate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Didn't even think about that. So Inma also had a very big presence on this Crims documentary.
Oh, really?
Because she's Monse's sister.
Yes.
Right. So she really defended her sister, and she's like her biggest advocate for her innocence.
Good for her. Good for her.
Thing. So she came up a lot. And she said in the documentary that when he called her to say that they were coming to search the apartment and that Monse had been arrested, that she immediately went over to the apartment.
Oh.
And everything had already been blocked off, and nobody would let them near the apartment. Like, the street had been blocked off.
But the guy was inside it?
But he was inside the house, yeah.
Yeah, jeez.
And when they tried to come up, this is the weird part, is like, when they tried to come up, unless I understood it wrong, which is possible, she said she kept trying to get past the cops in a way. And so at one point she said that she was his mother. Because she was a much older sister.
Okay.
So at one point she had said she was like Santi's mother to let her come up.
Okay.
So she was also kind of present. So they got all these people inside the apartment while they're searching. So Inma was present. Santi was present. So all these people inside the apartment while they're searching. So it's just like a messy crime scene type of thing, right?
I'm losing more respect for Catalan,
the investigation.
Catalan police, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, so anyway, that's what she said in the documentary. So Monse, yes, arrested, right? So while in prison, Monse maintained her innocence through letters with her family and friends, and then during visits with her family and friends, she also was like, I did not do this, this has nothing to do with me. And it was Santi who hired her a lawyer, but he acted as like kind of a mediator between her and the lawyer. Because he was like a criminal.
Such controlling, you know?
So he was like a lawyer specialized in criminology. So he got her a lawyer and then kind of acted as the mediator between her and the lawyer.
That is,
even though he's also kind of like implicated in this, right?
Clearly.
Which is weird, right?
I mean, the fact that he could I totally get him saying, look, there's this friend of mine, he's a lawyer, you can use him, right? But then, you know, that's
like,
it.
Let me help you get a lawyer for you. Yeah.
But that's it.
As like, a boyfriend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And then from there on, it's like, well, you know, lawyer, client privacy and all, whatever you call
it.
Right.
He shouldn't have anything to do
with
the two of them, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Very weird.
So family and friends found it strange how much control he had over her case and claimed that he would limit their access to Monse by his constant presence. Her family complained that he had quite a hold on her. According to them, he monopolized her time and manipulated her to maintain the story between them. So this is what they said on this documentary,
Okay.
So when they insisted to Santi that they wanted more alone time with her, he would infer that she didn't want anyone else to see her there. So he would like speak for her and say, like, she just doesn't want anyone to see her like this.
Yeah. Very early 2000s. And the rest of history.
Which is not really that long ago.
No, I'm just joking. I'm so, like, as if that's it's always happened, unfortunately.
Yeah. So when they did get to speak with her, she mostly spoke of being moved to a better prison with better views and not about how she was going to defend herself against a crime that she's being accused of.
Better views, huh?
Yeah, like, well, once I can get here, then they're going to move me to a better prison where I can have, like, at least I'll have some views of some...
Sounds like that's what he's telling her, right?
Right, like, that's what her family was saying, is, like, that she was just, like, not really talking about, like, resigned to the fact that, like, I'm going to be in prison, but at least I don't have to be in this prison and I can move to this better one where I have views of the sea. I don't know.
I mean, I like powerful man, but I don't think I go that far.
That's not powerful to me.
No, but you know what I mean? Like, she's probably, that's her,
like, this guy, I will die for him. I'll go to prison for him.
This is what I gathered from.
Right? Yeah. It sounds like that.
Yeah.
It's so sad.
And I'm going to go into it right now.
Okay.
So in this documentary, her family went into great detail about the relationship between the pair.
Mm-hmm.
Should we take a break before I go into this relationship?
Let's do that.
Let's take a break. Okay, we're back.
Yes, we're back.
Okay, so this relationship between Santi and Monse.
Yes, this overpowering, controlling relationship, I think we can say already.
Yes, very much so. Mm. So he was her first and only real relationship.
Oh.
And she was head over heels in love with him. Okay?
Do you remember her age-ish?
She was in her 30s. They were both in their 30s.
Wow.
Yeah. So, according to them, before she met him, she had resigned herself to the life of a spinster, quote unquote.
Eh? Oh my gosh, spinster. It sounds like a Chinese girl.
So, without love or without any children in her life. And she was a teacher. She, like, taught kids and stuff. So, she liked kids, you know.
Still.
So, she just assumed she'd never find love, essentially.
Poor thing.
Yeah. So, she often referred to herself as an ugly duckling, because she suffered from back issues that caused her to have a noticeable hump, and her back issues gave her pain, a lot of pain.
Mm.
She met Santi on one of the excursions with the UES, so this is the hiking club, and he became her everything when he expressed an interest in her, almost to the point of idolizing him.
Mm. He was also going for a weak one, right?
Police were putting the pressure on Monse, threatening her that if she didn't give up her collaborators, she alone would go down for the crime. She continued to protect him and would not implicate any others. Police knew that they didn't really have a motive for the crime, but they ran with their theory that it was a game that had gotten out of control. They knew she hadn't acted alone, but they didn't have enough to charge anyone else. So basically, she's charged essentially because she lived there. And they found those drugs in her house and the matches.
Mm.
And it was at her house.
Well, and apparently now...
Where she was thrown.
And apparently now she's saying that it was a game that got out of control, right?
She didn't say anything.
Oh, right.
This is their theory. Oh. This is the police theory and the judge.
Okay.
Right? This is some game that just got out of control. So they only had her because that was her house.
It was too circumstantial.
It's off the terrace above her apartment, right? Remember? So she lived like on the third floor. And then there was like a set of stairs that led up to the rooftop terrace. And that was where they had thrown Elena off.
Yeah, and found the clothes.
The clothes were up on the terrace, the matches, everything. So her back problems and her size. So she was smaller than Elena. She was weighing less than 50 kilos. Which is like under 100 pounds for American listeners.
Thank you.
She would have needed assistance in carrying a body up a flight of stairs.
Yeah, true.
And then to heave it over the railing of the terrace.
Yeah.
So while Monse sat in prison, the judge indicted Santiago La Iglesia and Ana Echeguival. So on March 23rd, Ana, who was 32 at the time, was arrested based solely on the evidence that she had been the author of the first half of the second anonymous note. The family of Elena was surprised by the arrest. They thought it was strange to detain her, especially because it hadn't been determined that she'd even been at the scene of the murder. So they detained her, but not Santi. Right? Who pretty much lives at the apartment where it happened, right?
It's looking like it.
Okay. So, things get dark. So
I mean, they were already quite dark, but
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So, hold on to that, Chipella. Okay, so on May 7th, 2002, Montserrat Carreta was found dead in the prison bathrooms.
Oh my gosh.
This was determined to be suicide.
It's way darker.
Yeah. She hung herself with, like, a nylon rope.
Oh, my gosh.
She left a note to her loved ones proclaiming her innocence. Yeah. Sadly, the day she chose to take her life was on the anniversary of her brother's suicide, which happened years earlier that she'd never gotten over.
Ouch.
I know.
Oh, man. Trauma.
I know. So...
Now I got your warning.
Yeah.
It's like, whose criminal is that here?
Okay. I mean, can you... Yeah, and then you got this boyfriend that's, like, fucking screwing everything up for you.
This guy just totally controlled her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So sad.
You're in this, like, totally helpless situation, and then, yeah.
Like, that ladder...
And this love of your life is not making it easier for you,
I mean, if
you
will. He totally made this happen, apparently.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess he was probably, like, cloaking that he was helping her. By getting her a lawyer and being the intermediary.
He was just getting out of it himself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in June of 2002. So, let's see. Monse took her life in May.
Okay, next month.
In June of 2002, Anna Richa-Givelle was released with charges. So, that's what I read. With charges. So I suppose that means that she can be detained at a later date if they have further evidence against her. So she's within the statute of limitations.
She probably can't leave the country. Stuff like that.
I don't know if that's the case, but she's within the statute of limitations.
I don't know what that means, but yeah.
Well, I'll get into that in a minute.
Okay.
Not in a minute, maybe, but, you know,
later. In a bit.
Okay, so in September of the same year, the Giovanni family pressured investigators to look at the men in the hiking group for their potential involvement. They even held a press conference in October with their lawyer and posited that the homicide was committed during a role-playing game, end quote, that got out of hand and one that Elena was not voluntarily playing a part in.
Mm-hmm.
Many were shocked that Santi had escaped an arrest.
I mean, it's ridiculous. Even that woman, Anna, was, why, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, she wrote something, but is that all?
That's all, and that she had a fight with her at one of these excursions.
Yeah, I mean, still.
So people, like, witnessed them having an argument on one of these excursions.
The quote-unquote lover.
The lover spat. Wow. The lover spat, yeah.
It's even homophobic. It's like,
it's so homophobic.
She's not even gay.
We don't even know. We don't know if Anna's gay or
Anna might be.
Elena is clearly not gay.
Elena, yeah. She's clearly not gay.
Yeah.
Which is like.
So.
Anyway.
Okay. So many. So if you remember from the first episode, it was because it was Elena's sister who said on the Crims documentary that. So that Anna was from the Basque Country and that her and Elena were planning a trip to the Basque Country together.
I remember that.
And they were planning it out, but Anna was getting very, like, pesada.
A pain.
Like, come on, let's do this, let's plan this, let's do this, you know. And so, Elena kind of got fed up with her trying to push her to go to the Basque Country. The police were certainly convinced that his involvement, but it seems the investigating judge just wasn't. So the police were like on to him. They were like,
good.
This dude.
Good.
Is sketch, good, right? Good, like good. The police were definitely.
Good to hear.
And that came out in the Crims documentary and in the radio show that came out before the Netflix series.
Okay.
So there was this police investigator who was just like, totally all over Santi. Like,
did you watch both of them? Both the Netflix?
I did not listen to the radio show that was in Catalan. But I watched. No, I did not, because I would not understand a word. But I did watch the documentary on Netflix. So, although he'd been indicted along with Anna, there was no further progress to formally accuse him, and he was never detained, unlike the women in the case. Monse's family had never given up on clearing her name, and both they and Elena's family were convinced that the real perpetrators of the crime were still walking free.
Yeah.
Monse's sister, Inma, that we talked about earlier, she was so convinced of this that she hired her own lawyer and did a little investigating on her own. She found the pharmacy in the neighborhood where the drugs had been bought and showed the employees pictures of both Santi and Monse. They identified Santi as the one who had purchased the drugs.
Ooh.
She asked them if they had told the police this information, and they replied that they had not, because the police had never come to question them. So, she was also suspicious of how easily all of this damning evidence against Monse was found in her apartment. The drugs and the matches.
Maybe it was a plant.
She believed
I never thought about that before.
She believed all the items could have been Santi's,
And when she asked the judge why only Monsi was arrested, he told her that it was simply because Monsi was on the lease and that they didn't have anything on him.
Oh my God, that is ridiculous. Yeah. That is such lazy work. Sorry to say.
Yeah.
Catalan police lost another 30% of my respect. I'm just saying.
Listen, Douglas.
WTF.
These are very complicated things.
But... I mean, you know, oh, she's on a lease, thus everything in the apartment must be her. Like, you know, come on. She's even, we've been establishing that he's living with her. Come on. Everything in the apartment must be...
I'm going to go ahead. This is where I'm going to lay the blame. I think the police in this case, because I watched the documentary and the police... there was one dude that was like the lead investigator and he was totally
he knew it
Santi
okay
but it was the judge, it was the investigating judge,
okay,
and so the investigating judge thought
I've lost all my respect from the freaking Catalan judges, they're probably Spanish because they're imposing their views on Catalan people.
You know, he kind of had a say in what was going to be clearly you know.
See,
where they were going to go with the case.
I really liked that the judges were involved in the investigation.
I do too.
Up until now.
Yeah.
Though.
Because it is one person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I mean, let him like...
I mean, everybody can get tunnel vision and police as well, but...
Yeah, but like if your police is saying this, like you're a judge, maybe the police know more about evidence? No, I guess the judge should know
enough
about evidence.
They do.
But if the response is she's on a lease, that is the most lazy answer I've ever
Well, no, but you see, things that have to be proven. That's the thing.
Sure,
you
but...
You have to prove something.
Yeah, but you can't... That's the thing. Like, there's no burden...
They're thinking legally about the burden of proof in court.
Yeah, but...
The judge, right?
But the burden of proof
the
doesn't say it's her.
The cops are thinking, like, I want to find the guy, right?
But it doesn't say it's her over him just because she's got her name on the lease. You know what I mean? That's what
I'm
saying.
Yeah, I agree. I think the judge had tunnel vision and thought it was a lady thing.
Yeah. I mean...
Which is weird. Which is weird.
I mean, is it weirdy sexist? Lol. Anyway.
So, they said they didn't have anything on him, but he did have access to the apartment. He had his own set of keys.
Yeah.
He had knowledge of the system as a lawyer specializing in criminology. He was alone in the flat in the hours after her arrest and before the search. He had plenty of times to plant the drugs and the box of matches, which were used as evidence against Monse.
Yeah.
He was also known to be a dominant partner to Monse. When discussing the relationship, friends and family emphasized how obsessed she was with Santi and how the relationship had been extremely intense and all-consuming. Inma even relayed how in early 2001... Monsi had broken up with him because he only thought about sex. Santi sent her to be treated by his own therapist.
Oh my gosh.
For what he said was her inability to cope with her brother's suicide. And shortly thereafter, they were back together.
Oh my gosh.
So he's sending her to his own therapist. Getting her the lawyer. Getting her the psychologist. This guy.
It's like classic dominating...
So, Monse had even shared with family and friends that it was Santi and his mother who had recommended that she take the Noctamid found in her house for her back issues and to help her to sleep. So, they had also recommended the drugs that they found.
They're doctors and everything now, eh? Some educated family here.
So, in October of 2005, so this is...
4 years later.
So, yes, 4 years later, like, Anna was the last one, like, Monse died in 2002, and then Anna was released in June of 2002.
Mm.
So, in 2005, the case was filed and then put aside, like, basically closed.
Yeah.
When the judge decided that the, quote, solidity of the evidence, end quote, was not, quote, sufficient to support the accusations against Santi and Anna.
Solidity. I mean, I get it. It's a good word to use.
I mean, if you don't have enough. The Giovanni family was understandably shocked and dismayed at the closure, but had no choice but to move on. In 2007, they established a cultural association in Elena's memory, which awarded a literary prize to aspiring writers, a passion of Elena's.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Oh. But the case just seemed a mess and full of oversights.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we take another break before we get into the next part?
Let's do that.
Okay, we're back.
We're back.
So they closed the case. And then it stayed that way until 2017.
Man.
So that was in 2005.
It's coming closer to now.
Yep. So these two journalism students, Anna Prats and Iago Garcia, Primo.
That's Julie's surname.
Yes. They compiled all the information in the case, hoping to clarify the facts and review the police work for their final project. So this was just for like school project, right?
I like that.
As journalists. So they questioned why the search of Monse's home was done 2 months after the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And they questioned how, in the process of the search, the Noctamid and Matchbox were so readily discovered. The handwriting analysis tests performed at the time had since been rejected and deemed inaccurate by subsequent studies.
Oh my gosh, and she's killed herself.
So Dr. Sheila Querlat?
Yeah.
A specialist in forensic linguistics, along with a professor, Christoph Credens, supervised the work of student Rosser Jimenez, who wanted to compare the anonymous notes to known writing samples by Monse. He found that, quote, 80% of the variables that were analyzed did not coincide, end quote. Neither the lettering nor the way that she normally expressed herself were a match, and that the, quote, differences were notable.
Mm.
So the first note was written by one person, mm-hmm. and the second note was clearly written by two different people.
Right.
Okay. In 2018, mm-hmm. the radio show Crims,
mm-hmm.
which later became that docuseries mm-hmm. on Netflix, was aired on Catalan Radio. Okay. It was a 6-part episode.
Six parts? Wow, that's a lot.
On the radio show.
Hours yep. to film.
6-part episode series.
Wow.
On the radio. On the case of Elena Giovanni.
I mean, we got two, so we know there's a lot of information.
In the Crims one, it's only 2 episodes, huh?
Oh, okay.
In the documentary one, it's only 2 episodes. But so it's like 2 hours each. It's like an hour each episode.
Okay.
It's a great show.
You should learn Catalan.
That's why I don't know Basque. I don't have time. And I'm not very good at languages. Douglas, however, is very good at languages.
It's my hobby. That's why.
It is a hobby. And you're a linguist, so you love this stuff. So
I do.
I am not that person. That is not my brain.
I just.
My brain likes other things.
I got it. Crime.
I like crime. I like The Real Housewives.
Which is very good for this podcast. All my language skills are almost useless for this podcast.
Oh, come on. It's clave. All right, so a detective on the case, who is probably the same one I saw in the docuseries.
Right.
This is the main investigator.
Oh, yeah, you were saying there was one that believed the guy that was
Santi,
responsible.
So he took part in the show and was adamant that he knew Santi, mm-hmm. with the help of others, was the real killer. And that the investigating judge would not allow them to do their job.
Yes.
So he said that. So this is in 2018.
Wow.
He came out and said, we knew it was Santi, but the judge was
goods,
the one
goods.
That prevented us.
Restoring my faith in Catalan police. And I don't even know if it was the Catalan police or the Spanish police, but still.
Well, I mean, anybody can get tunnel vision. So it's not like a, it's not a, in those kind of jobs.
Yes.
I mean, if you're investigating crimes.
Tunnel vision, not television. Yeah. You said television.
Did I say television?
I think so.
Anyway, I might have. I've had a few
years. It was on television, so
it was on television. Yeah, so tunnel vision. So anybody can get that and have like an innate bias, you know?
Yeah,
like,
it's hard. It's, yeah.
So during quarantine in 2020, the docuseries came out.
Oh, everybody's home.
Netflix.
Nothing to do.
Nothing to do.
Okay, let's solve some crime.
And this sparked a new interest in the case all over again when that came out. There were a number of revelations by people who hadn't come forward before in this series.
Ooh, of course.
For example, Ana Echeguivel, mm-hmm. or Basca, she had requested that the leader of the UES hiking group be investigated.
Ooh.
So she was like, look at this guy.
Okay.
A neighbor of Santi and Monse also appeared and shared that around noon on the day before the crime, he saw Monse wearing dark glasses and walking as if extremely inebriated, being held up by two young men, one of which was Santi, and because he knew him as his neighbor, and the other, in one place I saw that it was Xavi. So Xavi's going to come up now.
Cam.
So, some places didn't name him mm-hmm. as the other person holding her up. So, we got Monse being kind of basically carried by two men. Okay. And she looks fucked up.
Yeah.
In the neighborhood.
Right.
The day before the crime.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then Shabby's going to come up here soon. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is Shabby the leader of the climbing club?
But he's in the club.
Okay.
He's in the club.
Okay. I mean, I recognize the name, but I forgot who he was.
No, he was originally who I thought I could link to the Basque Country when I was reading about this story.
Oh, he was but the suspect.
Everybody initially. I talked to was like, no, that's a Catalan name. I was like, damn it.
What was his name?
Shabby.
Oh, just Shabby, yeah.
Shabby.
Because
I assumed it was a Basque thing.
Some Basque people use that.
Because there's
name
a lot of Shabbies in the Basque Country.
But here's more Chab.
XA. No, it's XA. Yeah. In Catalan, it's XAVI. But in Basque, yes. It's BI. Oh, XABI.
Sure.
They spell it Shabby. There were so many questions that the public and the families of the victims wanted answers. Good. Was Monse also drugged and therefore unconscious during the execution of the crime?
Good point.
And unable to provide the police with information?
Yeah.
Why did police find no fingerprints in the search of the apartment or in Elena's car? Because remember, they found her car parked mm-hmm. near their house.
True.
And they found no foreign fingerprints in her
remember
car.
Remember that? Everybody has to watch the first episode. I mean, it's a bit late to tell them now, but...
You can't watch it, but you can listen to it.
You know what I mean. Good point, Julie. Good point.
We are not a docuseries. That's one day. Douglas, one day. And we'll reenact everything.
I mean...
No,
I can
we
narrate
won't.
It.
We
won't. I don't think I'm that much of a good actor.
Okay.
But Netflix will tell us what to do.
Yeah. Because we're definitely getting on Netflix.
Hi, Crims. We love you, Crims.
Yes. Okay. If Santi was involved, why wouldn't he get rid of the evidence before the police showed up for this search?
Oh, is he just totally incriminating the girl?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
Unless he wanted to pin it on Monse.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
So why hadn't the men in the hiking group had their handwriting compared to the mystery notes?
Yeah, that's the judge.
Yeah.
Tunnel vision judge.
Or why weren't their alibis more closely scrutinized?
Yeah.
So, most were convinced that there was certainly no way that Monse could have carried an unconscious Elena up the flight of stairs and lifted her over the railing to her death.
That's a crucial part, I think.
Yes.
In the beginning, like, you're kind of like, oh...
And Anna was only linked to the notes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they had no link to her
very...
at her apartment where they threw her over the railing, right? Okay, ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
In another... Hang on to your chapella.
Hanging on.
There we go. In another twist, Elena's family had since discovered on her computer's hard drive some
notes.
Very interesting email exchanges that she had had with another member of the hiking group.
Okay.
Xavi Jimenez.
Ooh.
He had expressed his desire to take other excursions with her and discussed her intentions to learn English.
Oh, that...
Which was
the
note.
We never knew why that was there.
In the second note that he mentioned, like, and then we can go practice our English together or something. Right?
Oh, my gosh.
So, which you may recall was something that was mentioned in the second note. Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Friends of Elena's told the family that she had suspected Shabby was behind the notes and packages. And, you know, those packages of drinks and food. So she told people in emails, in her hard, they found all this in her hard drive. Like, she'd written people saying, like, Shabby sent these drinks and packages to my house. I know it's him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, right. So she got it. Okay, good.
She also wrote that she had actively, so it was clear because she'd spoken to friends and family that she actively avoided him at the hiking club because he pursued her romantically and she was not at all interested.
Oh my gosh, the layers.
Mm-hmm. In the computer, they also found that in some of the chat groups she participated in, there was an individual who remained anonymous but was continuously harassing her.
Oh my gosh.
The Jubani family's lawyer who represented them after her death had since died, and they couldn't afford to hire a new one, so they put out a public plea for funding and received it within 24 hours.
Nice.
Yeah.
10 points COVID.
Like a GoFundMe, yeah. I don't know what they call it here. Like, it's in the States, they have a GoFundMe.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't
like
know. I guess that's
there must
the only...
be something like that, yeah.
A new investigating judge had also been placed on the case.
Good, finally.
Whoop, whoop. And when he had a look at the email evidence and its connection to the mystery letters, he agreed to reopen the proceedings with the court of first instance number 2 of Sabadell on August 3rd, 2020.
Oh my gosh, we're getting so close to now. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So.
Good for a new judge.
So, Juan Giovanni, Elena's brother, was very present in this crimes documentary as well.
Another brother.
So her brother and sister, Elena's brother and sister, were pretty present, but Juan, her brother, he has insisted throughout this long and arduous road to justice that he believes that the two men, Santi La Iglesia and Xavi Jimenez, were directly involved in Elena's murder. And that two other men in the hiking club, Jaume... So this is one of the names, San and
like,
Francis.
Technically, we're supposed to say San Liehi.
Actively helped these men to cover up the crime, so those two. The new investigation would bring these four men in to testify before the court. Santi La Iglesia, which I'll remind you, is a criminal lawyer. So do with what that what you will, okay?
Yeah.
He insisted that he never lived at 48 Calvet de Estrella Street with his girlfriend, Monse Carreta. But neighbors contradicted this.
Mm-hmm.
They saw him on the daily. They assumed he lived there.
Mm-hmm.
As did the property manager. Mm-hmm. He said that Santi had lived in the apartment since the fall of 2001 when Monse requested that he be placed on the rental agreement.
Oh,
boom.
10 points, Monse.
Mm-hmm. He frequented pharmacies in the neighborhood, as Monse's sister found out by doing her own little investigation.
Mm-hmm. Not only frequented, but bought the medication.
The medication involved in the crime.
Found in the body. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In addition, when police arrived to search the apartment 2 months after the crime, it was Santi who had opened the door for them.
Yeah.
He remained unsupervised in the apartment for 6 hours after Monse's arrest earlier that day. And he was making phone calls and giving him, this gave him plenty of time to like manipulate items inside the apartment. Juan Giovanni, Elena's brother, feels that he would have the criminal know-how to get rid of evidence that would implicate himself and Monse in the crime.
Mm.
But police easily discovered the pills and the matches in the apartment linking Monse to the crime. So was he setting up his girlfriend to take the fall?
And maybe they never checked.
Maybe not.
Maybe they never checked for the fingerprints, but he could have just put the medicine there and wiped his fingerprints, is my...
Well, they didn't even look for fingerprints,
yeah,
apparently.
Yeah, that's the thing. They probably didn't, but...
They didn't. They didn't collect any fingerprints from the apartment. They didn't... From her car, nothing.
Because for me, just finding that medication there is incriminating enough. I like it, and I would... Like, if I was the lawyer, I mean, I wouldn't even want the medicine there, right?
Exactly. That's what her brother is saying. That's what Elena's brother is saying. It's like,
never mind the fingerprints.
This guy would know that this is going to link, because everybody knew that her body was found with these drugs in her system.
Yeah.
He would think, I want to get rid of any evidence that links me and Monse to this.
And he clearly bought it.
And he didn't. He left them there. They were there to be found really easily.
That's so weird.
On her side of the bed, right?
Oh my gosh.
He also was the one who procured her lawyer and acted as her mediator between the lawyer and her, and then like complicated any communication she had with her family and friends by always being like omnipresent.
Yeah. He's responsible for 2 deaths so far.
So
clearly.
They then focused on Santi's alibi on the days in question. So up to now he has offered several alibis. He claimed to be at a protest against the construction of a new golf course. A witness came forward to testify that Santi was not present.
Oh, nice.
He said he was playing football on the Friday Elena disappeared, but no one saw him.
Oh, my gosh.
In the documentary, Crims, the investigator in charge said he claimed to have gone to a Sabadell football match. And that's what I told you in the first episode.
Yeah, in the beginning, yeah.
A place with no cameras and without any proof that they had attended. It's like no ticket stubs, no nothing to show that they had actually gone to this game.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Giovanni also points out that when the police officer in charge of the case appeared in the documentary, Crims, openly stating that he is convinced Santi is responsible for Elena's death, he did nothing to defend himself against his accusation.
Wow.
Juan said, quote, "If they accuse me of something like that, I would file a complaint. It is not the normal reaction of someone who is innocent."
Totally. I'm with you.
The judge conceded that he did indeed live with her at the time of the events, and he was, quote, "the only male," end quote, "who spent long periods in the building where the murder was committed. He will be required to submit samples for DNA testing, and if he objects, they will be obtained, quote, "without his will or consent," end quote.
Nice. In your face.
So I'll get to the DNA later. Because up to now, we haven't talked about any DNA evidence.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, so on December 1st, 2021, the new judge finally decided to have a look into Xavi's movements and alibi.
Good, good, good. Yeah, I'd say the first judge was apparently one of the big problems. He could have been in the pocket of
this oversight lawyer or something. Guy. I don't know.
You know?
Or oversight. I don't know. Maybe he had a lot of cases on his table. I don't know. Anyway, so this was just one day. So December 1st, 2021, they decided to look into Xavi. And this was one day before the statute of limitations was to expire on the court's ability to bring charges against him.
Remember,
we talked about this in another case. There is a 20-year statute of limitations on murder.
Is it already 20 years?
It's been, yeah, because it was 2021, and it was 2001.
2000s, yeah.
December 2001. Isn't that crazy? I still think that's fucking wild that there's a statute of limitations on murder.
Yeah. I mean, ridiculous.
Right? So.
Murder. I mean, I'm happy for...
Murder, right? Murder.
Like, maybe 50 years, but not 20. Like 50, right? Like, you're probably too old to commit another murder. But 20?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. So, one day, they got to Xavi to look into him one day before.
I mean, it's a good story, Julie. Well found.
So, the crime did end up reaching the statute of limitations, but not for those who had been charged at some point. So, Santiago La Iglesia, Ana Echeguivel, or Basca, and now Xavi Jimenez. For them, the court has until 2025. So because they started looking into him, they were able to extend it to 2025.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
We have till
2025. So just opening it is enough to stress
to that. To start looking at him as a suspect.
Oh, good to hear, good to hear. I thought they had to find...
But now they only have until 2025. We're now in 2024.
Sure, okay. Okay. Well, it's a few years.
So the court requested that Xavi Jimenez provide them with samples of his handwriting from 2001. But he claimed that he didn't have any. Linguists with the National Police on the case decided to compare his current handwriting with that of the anonymous letters. In April 2022, they concluded that the author of the first note was, in fact, Xavi.
Wow.
Conceding that the first report was mistaken, the new investigating judge in the case stated, quote, "There is sufficient evidence to attribute Xavi Jimenez the material writing of the anonymous letter of September 17th, 2001. End quote. As for the second note, Xavi claimed to be working on October 9th, 2001. So these were the dates that those notes were delivered to her house, right? But the judge went on to say, quote, "It does not exclude that he participated in the writing or communication of the information necessary to carry it out," end quote.
Sure.
So it doesn't exclude him from having written it. The judge also decided to summon two witnesses concerning Xavi's alibi on the day of the murder. So they wanted to determine where Xavi was at noon on Friday, November 30th, 2001. Another member of the hiking group, Jaume he was interviewed in 2001 after the crime because he was part of the hiking club, right? He, as were all of the other members of the hiking club. Everybody was interviewed by police at the time because that was the link she had, right? To the hiking club, because remember in the second anonymous note, they mentioned the hiking club.
Yes.
And that's why they started looking at the hiking club that she was involved with.
Because the second...
The second note...
Note came with the drug drink as well. Yeah. Right? So...
And they mentioned the hiking group in the note saying, like, maybe on the next excursion, mm-hmm. something.
Yeah.
So they interviewed everybody in the hiking club, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they interviewed him in 2001. And in his first statement, he told police that he was out having beers with some friends in Barcelona, which did not include Xavi. However, he later returned to speak with police to change his statement. He claimed that he was confused about the day in question and modified his story to say that he was in fact with Xavi. They had spent the afternoon together preparing for an excursion the group was taking on December 1st. And if you'll recall from episode one, there was an excursion on December 1st, the day after Elena went missing.
Yeah, but they didn't go.
And Montse went, Santi went.
No, they thought they didn't.
Xavi and Jaume also went on this excursion.
Okay.
I
remember the excursion, but I thought somebody hadn't gone.
But then her body was thrown from the building that night.
The night before.
December 1st mm-hmm. on Saturday night.
So before
so the... that it was discovered Sunday morning.
Right.
So Friday she disappears. Saturday they go on the excursion. Sunday morning they discover her body because it was thrown Saturday night, yes. early Sunday morning, like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
Thank so you they for so they believed that she was like unconscious in Monse's apartment
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
during that overnight. Time while they were on the excursion.
Oh really?
Right. Like they oh. all went on this excursion but kept her like drugged up.
Oh my gosh. And, like, no, I didn't realize that. That's yeah. horrible. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm trying to keep up, but it's confusing.
Well, it's been a few weeks since we did the first episode, so I can understand why you don't. And I've been living with this case
you researched,
for a while yeah. because I've been writing
it. You sorted it out. You sorted yeah. out all those things.
So I'm just reminding you, okay?
Thank you.
So they did take this excursion, the group, on that day. Elena wasn't there because she disappeared the mm-hmm. Friday before. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he comes forward to say, no, he went... He first said that he was with friends in Barcelona mm-hmm. drinking beers, then came back to say, no, actually I was with Xavi and we were planning this excursion that we're taking on Saturday, December 1st. Mm-hmm. The day after she went missing, right? Mm-hmm. So, 20 years later, when the case was being reinvestigated, a friend of Jaume's came forward to confirm that Jaume's first version of events was actually true.
Oh.
He had been with Jaume in Barcelona having drinks, and the outing did not include Xavi. Totally oh. dismantling Xavi's alibi.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good.
The formal investigation has always been convinced that the person or persons involved in Elena's murder were the same ones who wrote her the anonymous notes and that were delivered to her house with the drinks laced with heavy doses of stupefying drugs. The same drugs they found in her system at death. Xavi maintains that he had nothing to do with the notes and has since changed his alibi to say that he was at home with his father. So now he has a different story.
Sure.
Conveniently for him now, his father is suffering from memory loss and cannot corroborate his son's claims.
Man.
He also couldn't answer why he didn't make it to work on Monday. Sure. So the body was discovered Sunday. He didn't show up to work on Monday. Neither did Monse and Santi.
Mm-hmm.
All three of them did not show up for work that they were scheduled to show up for on
Some
Monday.
Heavy evidence there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, when Xavi was brought to testify, he would only respond to questions posed by his own lawyer and refused to answer any inquiries from his accusers. He painted himself as a victim the whole time. The judge in the case made it clear that Xavi was the only person under investigation who had been romantically rejected by the victim, whom he had met through the hiking club. He learned about her love of horchata, which was one of the drinks delivered to her house along with the mystery notes. Prior to her death, Elena herself had confessed to a friend that she suspected Xavi to be the one who had written the notes, stating that, quote, he was after her, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
She even stopped going to some of the hiking group's meetings to avoid running into him.
Yeah, you were saying before, you know, she avoided him during the walks.
Mm-hmm.
As so, well. Mm-hmm.
Following the court procedure, the judge charged Xavi with the alleged crime of murder.
Oh.
And then released him. But not before taking away his passport and prohibiting from leaving the national territory. So he now is required to appear in court every month to, like, just verify that he's in the country.
Yeah.
and that he can be called at any time to appear before the court. Okay, so the other witness called to testify in 2022 was Francisc Macià.
Macià.
The president of the hiking club and the one who Anna insisted police take a closer look at. At the time of Elena's death, he gave police very little information, and in his re-interview 20 years later, he claimed to remember practically nothing. Investigators believe he knows more than he's telling, and Joan Giovanni, Elena's brother, he believes he is covering for Santi and Xavi. He points out that Francisc was on the phone for hours with the three men, Santi, Xavi, and Jaume, the weekend of the crime. Apparently there's proof of this, but I didn't see that written anywhere, but except for this statement by brother in a news article.
Pre-2000s, I do remember getting phone bills that actually said the things that we used to do. Now they just send you a giant bill and they didn't ever tell you why. But those, I remember the days.
You used to be able to catch your partner. Whose number is this?
Well, you used to go like, oh, look, I talked 20 minutes to that chap. You know? Yeah.
Anyway. So he also points out that they went on that excursion December 1st together. So he thinks that gave them plenty of time to sort out their stories.
Yeah.
If they were all kind of like collaborating.
I mean, apart from the friggin' long phone calls, they don't need to go on an excursion as well. But anyway, just saying.
Well, they already had it planned, right? And if you recall, Santi and Monse were never, they never actually signed up for the hike that they did on December 1st, that Saturday. And then they just went last minute.
Right.
So they, like, I guess they were like, who wants to go on this excursion? People signed up. Those are the people, like, signed up for the excursion. And then Santi and Monse
turned up
last minute for that excursion on the Saturday following her disappearance. So the brother, Joan, he cannot fathom why Jaume and Francisc wouldn't tell investigators what, if anything, they know, considering that the statute of limitations has expired for them on the case. So because they've never been named in anything or charged, they don't really have anything to fear. They're not going to be charged with anything. That's so they could easily come forward.
Yeah, that's weird,
and
though.
Say what they know, right? So he thinks, like, for humanity's sake, they should tell what they know.
That's a good point. I agree with him there. If they hear that, maybe they could be convinced.
I'm sure they are hearing everything about this case. This is probably not...
It's talk of the town, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if they this is a small town. Sabadell is not a big town. Yeah.
And if they raise the money on the, you know, for hiring a new lawyer overnight, like, it's clearly got...
Also might be, like, worried about your reputation as, like, what you hired. You hid this for that many years. How dare you? You know, like, you might lose your...
I mean, for sure. And then, again, that's another kind of social pressure.
But have the balls to be, like, do the right thing, you know?
I mean, that's... I would hope.
But, yeah, you know, some people can't do the right thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's true.
So... I'm going to finish up with Joanne, her brother says. So he is unsure what role Monse played in the murder, but has said, quote, she is a victim, but is she completely innocent? Her family believes she is, because her sister Inma is like her biggest, like, she had nothing to do with it.
Good for her.
But we've always believed that she was involved. The evidence indicates it.
Yeah.
Only clarifying how Elena died could tell us if she is completely innocent, if she acted involuntarily or subdued by Santi La Iglesia. End quote. As for our final suspect, still under investigation and our Basque link to this case, Ana Echeguibel, she can still be charged at any time until December 2025 for the murder of Elena. The only proof that placed her under suspicion at the time was, firstly, the judge's tunnel vision that this was a woman's thing and only focused on Monse and Anna in the hiking club. Anna had been seen having a heated argument with Elena on one of the group's excursions. And because the judge was so fixated on the ladies, they were the only ones who had their handwriting samples compared with the writing in the anonymous notes.
Terrible.
which at the time were determined to be a match, but the results were later debunked and found to be more closely matched the writing of Xavi Jimenez, mm-hmm. who was never even considered a suspect.
I mean, that bit is crazy.
Anna had shared a cell with Monse when the two were arrested, but mm-hmm. she was released when her alibi was corroborated. Mm-hmm. She was somewhere else that weekend, and she could prove it. So, although she is technically under suspicion until 2025, yeah. because she was at one time charged with the crime, I don't think we'll be seeing any new charges brought against yeah. her. So, yeah. Arbasca is going to be okay, I think.
She seems safe, yeah.
Should we take one more break before I do the last bit? It's not very long.
Yeah, let's just do this. And then
we can do our mini crime time in the last very bit of our... Because I'm going to get into the DNA. All right, we're back.
We're back.
Somewhere.
No, I screamed and it said something. Hi, everybody. We're back.
Hello.
We're back.
Okay. All right. Let's get to the end of this story. Okay.
Yes,
so,
ma'am. Yes,
I told you before that there was potential DNA evidence in this case.
Yes, it was over my head. So let's get into my head.
Let's get into it. So since the time of the crime, 2001... there have been significant advances in DNA technology.
True. Tell me about it. Yeah.
So in 2022, new tests were carried out on the clothing that Elena was wearing on the day of her murder.
Oh.
They were able to retrieve two DNA samples from the brown sweater that Elena wore and that was found on the rooftop terrace.
Okay.
The day that they discovered her body.
Yep.
Okay. So they compared both samples to Xavi and Santi, and they both came back as inconclusive.
Oh.
However, the court concedes that the samples they retrieved were not in the best state to be tested. Additionally, Elena's family has requested that the samples be tested against the two women who are initially accused of her murder, Monse Carreta and Ana Echeguibel.
Mm-hmm.
And it is unclear whether or not they honored this request.
I'm just going to correct you a little bit and say DNA has not advanced that much since 2020. I mean, in the sense that...
are you kidding? Yes, it has.
All those four results are just inconclusive.
Absolutely it has.
But they're inconclusive.
But,
I'm just saying.
That was what, you know, I mentioned earlier today that I was listening to a podcast about the CSI effect. And everybody thinks that DNA is something so simple and like,
I understand it's complicated.
But it's super complicated.
But I thought we're going to get an answer. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, everybody thinks you're going to get... Exactly. You have the CSI effect. You think there's going to be a simple answer.
Just as well I'm not an investigator or a judge. Exactly. Or a judge.
Because you would just close the case.
I would. It was all the woman's fault. All the woman's fault, clearly.
Fuck the DNA evidence. Anyway. No, so anyway.
It's a joke.
So, on September 23rd, 2023, a year later.
Again, oh my gosh, we're getting close.
The judge requested new DNA tests.
Okay.
He specifically wants them to look for possible traces of DNA on the anonymous letters.
Oh.
And to retest the victim's sweater.
Good, good.
Okay. On the sweater, they found traces of DNA from Elena, a woman, and two men.
Okay.
They did not match our two suspects, Santi or Xavi.
Oh my gosh. I mean, still, it's a jacket, right? Like, it could have been everywhere.
So.
This is very confusing.
However, the tests that were done on the notes, the letters, they pointed to Xavi. But this doesn't incriminate him in the murder.
Right.
It only links him to the notes.
Sure. I'm happy with that.
They will continue to test as advancements allow, but they only have until December 2025.
Oh, no. I mean, okay, now I can criticize them a little in the sense that...
No, but, like, that's the thing about DNA. Everybody thinks it's, like, a sure shot.
I understand the complications.
Conclusive.
I was one of the...
But, like, her sweater could contain...
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of DNA. Her father's DNA.
Exactly, exactly.
Her mother's DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
It could contain all kinds of things.
But at the same time, like...
Somebody that bumped into her on the street. You know, like, it could contain all kinds of things.
But at the same time, inconclusive is, like, so open. It's like...
That was the previous one. And then they retested them.
Mm-hmm.
And the two male DNA samples that they did find on the sweater
didn't match those two guys. But that doesn't mean they didn't fucking kill her.
I know. I know.
At the same time, you know?
Yeah.
So there you go. That's where we're at.
That's it.
Gosh. This is an unsolved case. So Elena's murder is still unsolved, and they only have until December 2025 to figure out something.
This is almost like a, if you're a good DNA person.
I have a feeling they're not going to solve it.
Doesn't sound like it.
Mm-mm. I have a feeling that whoever killed her gets away with it.
And in a way, I would say this is a bit of a kind of condemnation of this. I'm sorry, but like for murder, it shouldn't be just 20 years.
No, of course not. You know what I mean? I think that every time I see that.
That's the main...
There should be no statute of limitation of the murder.
I mean, you know, call it 40, 50 years, but 20 years is just not okay.
No, there should be no statute of limitations on murder. Murder is fucking serious.
I get it. But, you know, I'm trying to think of Europe, okay? I was not born in Europe. I came to Europe.
Neither was I.
Europe is very nice in human rights. And I'm like, let's hear their point. And I'm like, you know,
what is the point?
I came from a place where you put somebody in jail for their whole life, and it's like it's a done thing. And
this I can understand, like the whole penalty thing. Yeah, I can understand.
And then you know, so in the same vein, like, you know, let's be nice to people. But I also, you know, yeah, I mean, you killed somebody. You shouldn't get away with that.
No,
I don't. I'm not. That's not what I'm advocating for. I'm just like, okay, if you take the most humane approach, like I understand people can get over it and maybe they didn't kill again, so let's say after 40 or 50 years you're like, well, you're probably not going to kill anymore, but 20 is not enough.
Sure. I can see that, yes, like this is not a potential
killer. I mean,
like
I
a potential threat to society.
I mean,
and that's what really what crime and punishment is all about, right?
Yeah, because
to prevent these people from doing the same harm to somebody else, right?
And in my heart, 20 years, that guy still might murder. But where it was 30, 40, 50, maybe not. But 20, he can still kill. He's young enough and he's strong enough to carry somebody up to the second, fourth floor or whatever, right? You know what I mean?
One flight of stairs.
You know, he's 20 years later, he's still strong enough. He's still 50.
And that is really diabolical, too, like to have drugged someone, keep them like captive in an apartment for over 24 hours, right? Drugged up.
Yeah.
Go on an excursion.
Yeah.
And then come back and then decide to throw her over the ledge to get rid of her because you've already done something. And remember, they found that white liquid substance in her vagina and they couldn't identify it. And that, to me, is, like, the weirdest part. It's, like, that they've never identified what they found in her vagina.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't prove any sexual assault or anything, but they did find some weird white liquid substance in her vagina. And, like, so has not testing evolved?
Yeah.
I mean, I understand test. Like, that was the thing I was hearing today in this podcast I listened to. It was about that CSI effect. It was, like, you have to know what you're testing for, right? Like, so when they talk about like toxicology reports, you have to test for certain things. You have to go, we're looking for cocaine. Is there cocaine?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can't just go,
I understand.
Anything, like just test for anything and everything. There's no like test to do that. Like to just go anything that comes up, you know?
Yet. That we know of. Yeah.
So they still don't know what that liquid was that they found in her vagina. So that could have been something to cover up some sort of sexual assault, right?
Yeah.
So
I'm going to end this with my little
tribute to Elena, okay?
But, yeah, just kind of also just want to just throw it out there that if you know anything that might help, you know, contact the authorities and it would be super cool.
So just even I wrote this at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The real hero in this case is our girl, Elena.
Mm-hmm.
Her initial journalistic instincts prompted her to look into her own drugging after drinking the contaminated juice left on her doorstep. Her body linked those tests done on the juice to the drugs she ingested before being thrown to her death.
Yeah.
She saved the notes that accompanied the drinks, which gave police some evidence linking the notes to her murder.
Yeah.
She spoke with friends by email, sharing her suspicions about Xavi. Mm-hmm. She totally assisted them in solving her crime. Mm-hmm. Hopefully for her, her family, and friends, someday this soon will all be resolved.
Yes. And it's very nice that there's this literature prize linked to her as well, right? Yeah. It's appropriate that through her writing, she kind of did as much as she could to help find the people responsible.
Like, she handed the police. Mm,
yeah, as much as she could.
Mm. All the evidence to fucking solve her crime, essentially. Yeah. Like, girl was on it, poor
good
thing.
For her. Good
and
for
she was, like, 27. She was 27.
Yeah,
she
that's...
She was a baby.
Too young. In my defense, and in defense of the investigators, there's too many people involved. It's not so easy to figure out what
never
was happening,
is.
Right? Mm-mm. It was... quite complicated. Yeah. In any case, we have a mini crime time.
Yeah, should we do mini crime time?
Mini crime time!
So, we would like to not get sued by any Batman.
I mean, you're TV assuming show. Our rendition was so
we're
close.
Assuming that we're assuming that our podcast is going to even get to the ears of anyone that would care.
I mean, don't put us down tone that much.
But... Oh, come on. Let's put us down.
I mean, you're right that like a room full of people are listening to us, like 50 people-ish.
12.
No, it's 50 after
my mom,
a month or two. Like all
your mom.
Every podcast knows my mother never listened to any of them, so you don't need to count her.
No, I'm kidding. Okay. Anyway.
Our mini crime time.
Okay. So I thought we would talk about something that was like joyful
exactly.
for Bilbao.
Yes.
That
very
recently.
Recent in our real, in IRL.
IRL.
Where we live.
So we're speaking in April, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And this is probably not going to come out till like May, right? So recently, Athletic, mm-hmm. our football team.
Yes.
Of Bilbao.
Athletic Bilbao.
Athletic
known
Bilbao.
As
it's
Athletic.
The name, yeah, Athletic, as they pronounce it here, but it's Athletic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Spelled Athletic because it was founded by British and...
Yeah.
Basque people.
Yes. So what we're saying and not saying is just don't say Atletico.
No, yeah.
Athletic.
Athletic, but they say Athletic.
Atleti, yeah.
Or Atleti, yeah.
Yeah.
But not Atletico, right?
But they won the Copa Real.
No, the Copa del Rey.
Sorry.
Del Rey. The King's Cup.
I was close.
The King's Cup.
I mean, Real is...
But
royal.
They've been to the... In the time that I have lived here, uh-huh. they have got to the final.
To the final, yes.
Of the King's Cup, I think at least...
Six times, according to our straight man in the room?
Six times.
10 points.
I remember
I would have
three
said
times.
Two. I would have said two.
I remember three times. And always it's like Barcelona. So what I can recall is like the first time it happened, I had just moved here and I couldn't believe like the hoopla that they were putting on for mm-hmm. it. Like there was big screens around town. Everybody was having parties and shit. And they were waiting for the Gabara, right? The boat to go down the river with the team on the boat.
Yep. So just for people to a bit of context. So the Copa del Rey. So the Cup of the King.
It's only a Spanish thing. Right?
Yes.
Spanish league thing.
So it's within the Spanish states and all the occupied countries within its borders. And so any team within the state is allowed to play and somebody is going to get the cup.
Right? Yeah.
And
from
so,
the king.
From the king. And that is
why... The king's
why,
always there.
That's why the national TV never lets you hear what people are screaming because they're all very, you know...
I don't know
political.
What that
like a lot of the screams...
Anti-king? Or
well,
what?
When it's Barcelona against Athletic, I can guarantee you that it's a lot of anti-king rhetoric.
Oh, sure.
In the stadium.
Because Barcelona... Oh, that really links to our show tonight, Catalan.
A bit.
Anyway.
Catalonia.
Anyway, so I have seen it a few
and
times.
And then another part that our listeners might not know is the Gabata, which we were mentioning.
Oh, yeah, the boat.
Is a kind of a flat boat that, I don't know,
barge.
Used to be a barge, thank you. Used to be used many years ago. And there's a tradition
the last
here.
Time it went...
40 years ago.
No, 40.
The last time it was used 40 was 40 years ago.
40 years ago.
So the last time they won...
This King's Cup.
Was 40 years ago. And what they do with the barge is, because Bilbao is on a river, it goes up into the heart of town, kind of like...
With the whole team on board.
On board, which
yeah.
is the celebration.
to celebrate, and then everybody on the sides, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway,
Guggenheim Museum.
So my mini crime time, yeah, is for tonight. Is about like mostly about like stories I heard from my student this week, who went to Sevilla because they've held the final in Sevilla, yes. Even though the team neutral. They were playing against was Mallorca.
Right, Mallorca. Okay?
So yeah. It was Mallorca against Atleti.
Yeah, Bilbao.
I don't know what Mallorca's team was. Is it? What's it called?
Real
Mallorca. Okay. So that was the team they were playing against. So they pick a neutral city to play the final match, and it was in Sevilla. So in Sevilla, like...
Seville for the English.
Or Seville, players. Yeah, in English. they went to... so how many Bascos went down?
Like, apparently, according to you, at least 100,000.
So some say 100,000, others say 70,000. Uh-huh. But that's a lot of fucking Bascos.
10,000?
And Basque Country is like 2 million.
Yeah, we're not that big.
It's not that big of a place. No. So that's a lot
it's
of people.
It's a big party.
Yeah. So they went down. Another mini crime time, if I want to go into this, is like that they, in Sevilla, they just like jack the prices of hotel stays or Airbnbs and stuff.
That's a crime.
So like, yeah, that's a crime. That's so like they, a friend of Ali's said that he looked at prices for a Airbnb one weekend and it was like 40 euros a night, then became like 500 euros a night.
Wow.
Because of the Sevilla, like the match, right? Oh,
gorging.
Yeah, gorging. Prices. Yeah. Okay, so that's one mini crime time. So anyway, so all these Bascos go down. And I just want to talk about like things that happened.
Sure.
While they were there. They're not necessarily crimes.
I mean.
That price gouging is one crime.
Some countries
consider that is actually a crime. So I'll leave that at that. But so my student told me that she went with her sister.
Oh.
And they went to the fan zone. So they like they couldn't go to the stadium. A lot of the tickets were sold out. Mm-hmm. In the stadium, they said there was like 40,000 Bascos supporters.
Sounds cool.
Which is a lot of fucking people.
It is.
That's a lot of people.
It is.
So 40,000 people in the stands. But then they create like these fan zones for them. They set up like around big screens, city. Right? Mm-hmm. So for everybody to watch the match, right?
That's where we watched it here.
The Basques had set up a bar that was 170 meters long. So that's a big bar.
It's pretty big.
Like a really long 170 bar. Meters. Okay, do the math, everybody. That's a big fucking bar.
Oh, yeah. Tell your listeners who don't understand meters.
Well,
do you want me to ask?
I mean, the closest I can go to is like yards, which is like close to a meter. Because a yard is like 3 feet.
Okay, it's 185 yards, Julie.
Okay, 185 yards. There we go.
Just Googled it.
So that's pretty fucking big bar.
Whatever that is.
So in like in local television in Sevilla, they were being interviewed. They were interviewing like locals that were saying like, "That's an exact what the hell?
Why
do they have such a big bar?
Do they really need it?
Yeah, what an exaggeration.
They'll never use it.
Yeah,
they'll be all in one corner.
And they were wrong
because
the Bascos. Fucking went to the bar.
You're saying your friends.
Yeah, she said when she goes, it wasn't an exaggeration because I was always three people deep.
Three people deep in a bar.
So like she always had to be, like she had to wait a long time to get a drink, and she was three people deep every time.
Yeah. One
like,
person at the bar, somebody between her and
and then she was still behind them, like going, "Hey, I want a drink too."
Oh my gosh! Yeah, so that's clearly not enough.
It was not an exaggeration.
Bar.
They should have made it longer.
Way longer
to serve everybody.
At least double. But it works so well with the...
So that's one thing.
With the typical Bilbao joke.
There was literally a Basque invasion of Sevilla.
You need a world map of the Basque country, right?
Oh, yes.
It's like everything is big. Times. No, but it's a part of the lore.
Of course.
It's the lore.
We are huge.
And it makes sense with that lore, right?
Exactly. Like, we have to have a big fucking bar because
they always
we're going to
be
drinking.
And it wasn't even big enough.
It wasn't big enough to serve everybody.
It's a great one.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing was that she said when it was the following day and they were to get like a marianito the next day,
right?
Which is like a little martini.
like the vermouth drink.
Vermouth, yes. Just a dash of gin, not
sometimes. Not that's mainly gin. That's prepared, right?
Like yeah, yeah,
if you
yeah.
Order it prepared.
But I'm just gin. Saying, like a lot of people.
But it's like vermouth drink.
Yeah, in the U.S., they might think a martini is mostly.
Yeah, they think liquor. It's just gin, straight up gin, yeah. And make like a but splash of vermouth to make it dry. That's not
what we're drinking here. A dry it's mostly
martini or whatever. Anyway, so here it's like that actual. Drink martini that comes in a bottle.
Yep.
Okay. So they went to have these drinks and then down the river, because actually Sevilla is similar to Bilbao and they have a river that goes up it, right? There was a trinero, isn't that what they're called? The rowing?
Trainera. I think. Yeah, yeah, which is like a little boat.
No, they had brought the boat.
Uh-huh. Oh, she from Bilbao.
From Bilbao to go up the river.
It's not a crime. That's a nice one. That's a nice one. Maybe they're invading.
She was blown away that they had brought the boat from Bilbao to there. She showed me the picture. It had Kutxa Bank on the side.
Which is a local bank from the Basque Country.
We've done an episode on Kutxa Bank. Sure. Okay, so that was the other story.
It's so sweet.
From that. And then... after the party here, the Gabarra, right? Here. So here in Bilbao, they had a huge party, historical event, 40 years after the first one. And then the garbage.
That was, I was going to say, if you didn't say anything, I was going to say something.
Yeah, it's like, so the sides of the river were just plastered in garbage. Yeah, people brought their drinks.
They all sat next to the river and made a little camp picnic thing.
Yeah.
And then after the boat passed, they just left everything.
It was disgusting.
Which...
it's really disgusting.
It's so sad.
Like, as a person, would you ever do that? No. Would you ever bring in garbage then just drop it? Would you ever go for a picnic and just leave all your fucking trash there? Yeah. I never would. Like, that is, like, weird to me.
Yeah.
That you would just leave your garbage there.
Like, I get it for a couple of 18-year-olds, sort of, you know?
Not even when I was 18.
But the whole river was just...
it was so disgusting. And this is families. Trash. This is families and
trash all everywhere. Types
of people. So it was not, like, all 18-year-olds, right? Like
I didn't see who left the rubbish. We arrived, to be fair, when it was just... there were just bunches of people and rubbish everywhere, right? There was nobody, like, still there. I didn't ever see any... I don't even know if they were 18-year-olds. But I just imagine 18-year-olds could do that. I'm just hoping for excuses, to be honest.
The funny thing was that I saw that video of... there was, of course, a million fucking Vascos in Sevilla, right?
Right.
So they're all partying in the streets of Sevilla. Uh-huh. And then this woman came out onto her balcony.
Okay.
And someone was recording. Uh-huh. A woman comes out on the balcony and they all start singing to her the Marihaya song.
Oh. From Fiesta. Marihaya is and the it was kind amazing. Of patron saint character.
We've talked about this in our Bilbao Fiestas episode.
Maybe some people haven't listened to all of the episodes.
No, listen to it. The floods that sunk the fiestas.
Yeah,
we talk about Marihaya and her song.
I had heard.
So they
about
started
that.
Singing her song, to
and
her
she has and, no idea what the.
And
fuck
the
this
woman
is
that
about.
Came out on the balcony had no idea what she's was not happening. From Bilbao. But they were all singing to her the Marihaya song.
That's so cute.
So that's pretty funny.
That is very cute. And then it was a wedding.
Oh yeah, the wedding. Tell the story about the wedding.
It was just like a local couple who was getting, I think, married in a cathedral. So it was kind of downtown, in the middle of the whole thing, and they never knew that the final was going to be.
Yeah, they were. They just organized their wedding for this day. Yeah.
And then when it came out, they was like, "Los novios son del Atleti," or something like that, right?
Translate.
The couple are Atleti
supporters. Are Atleti fans,
And, you know, like, I think it was a bit colder in the beginning, but then they had a whole, like a carriage.
Right, like in Seville. Like, they have the horse-drawn carriage. Yeah,
it's typical down there. And so they had to go through the plaza. And then...
everybody's like, oh, Atleti or something.
They were totally into the party by then. They were like, yay, Atleti, and somebody gave them the flag of the team, and it was just and then they appeared on TV later saying it was crazy, it was so nice, it was very sweet.
And they're probably Atleti fans now.
I mean,
Or they have a special place in their heart.
Yeah.
Because on their wedding day,
they were
cheered on by Atleti fans.
Yeah, I think they won't oppose.
I would. If that happened on my wedding day, I'd fucking be
I would. Atleti. I would too. But yeah, lots of layers here. Lots of layers. No, it was a lovely time and a little bit of a historical event
in Bilbao.
But it was very fun. It was beautiful. Yeah. It was beautiful.
Yep. Mm. Anyway, so thank you for listening.
Thank you.
If this is long, we're very sorry, and we're not sorry.
No, we're not.
Good chat. We'll see you next time. Follow us on Instagram. Write to us at crimesofthebasquelands@gmail.com if you have a mini crime time you'd like to share.
Yeah, send us it.
And
that's us for now.
That's it. Yeah, thank you so much. We love you, and
we bid take care. You
agur.
Crimes of the Basque Lands is written and produced by
Douglas D. Carvalho,
Julie Garcia,
and Megan Dooley.
The sound and editing for each episode by
Douglas D. Carvalho.
I'm Megan Dooley.
Theme song written by
Douglas D. Carvalho,
Julie Garcia,
and Megan Dooley.
Sung by the choir with no name and produced by Tom Squires. Podcast art by Distinct Signal. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Crimes of the Basquelands, and contact us at crimesofthebasquelands@gmail.com with story ideas worldwide which have a connection to the Basque Country, or any rave reviews. If you like our podcast, please subscribe, like, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time,
agur!